Today we hear from the incredible Andy Gibson. Andy is the founder of Mind Apples, a social business teaching people how their minds work and encouraging everyone to take care of their minds like we take care of our bodies. Andy will discuss how apps and social tools are helping us to manage our minds more effectively and the role of technology in a mentally healthy society.
For many years, over a decade, I've been working in the world of public mental health. Mind Apples is a mental health organisation, but in the sense that we are interested in promoting good mental health. I'm not a doctor, I'm not treating illness. What we're interested in is encouraging and supporting everyone to take better care of their minds. Because what we all have mental health, and the things that we do make a big difference to it. And so we want to try and broaden that conversation out as much as possible to get everybody thinking about what they can do to look after their minds and sharing what works for them. So for many years we've operated as a charity doing campaign work, encouraging people to share what works for them and learn more about looking after their minds. So we've been in conferences and workplaces, music festivals, youth groups, schools, universities, all kinds of different settings, asking people, what do you do that is good for your mind? A lot of our work actually has ended up being about connecting people up together face to face. Perhaps isn't that relevant for what we're talking about today, and increasingly, of course, is a challenge for any organisation that is interested in promoting face-to-face conversations, although I'm sure we will be able to get back to that at some point. There definitely is a pressure on all of us to try and figure out how to replace those face-to-face connections with technology and later, of course, to augment what connection we can have. And so at Mind Apples, we are thinking about tech, but actually it is my background anyway, because before I started Mind Apples, I worked in the world of technology and particularly in trying to apply technology to solving social problems. And so my previous organisation before Mind Apples was a startup called School of Everything, which worked as a kind of eBay for learning. We were connecting up people who wanted to learn things with people who might be able to teach them in their communities and brokering those kinds of informal learning networks that exist outside of institutions. So for a very long time, I've been interested in the power of technology to improve our lives and help us to create the society that we want. And I started Mind Apples originally as an online campaign to ask people the five a day for their mind, get the people to share it online and then promote more of these conversations. And we continue to do that. If you look at mindapples.org, you'll see some of the work that we continue to do in that area. Also, to give you a bit of background to mental health as a topic, because it's something that is thrown around a lot. We talk about it increasingly now. We didn't so much when I started. Back in 2008, when I was starting Mind Apples, it was much less discussed, and we have come a long way. And in particular, we've seen a lot of organizations getting better at talking about mental illness, or high profile celebrities, campaigns, business leaders, the royals, of course, all talking about the struggles they've had and the things that they found were helpful. What we're trying to do is still to push that a little bit further, because it can still feel a bit like the only people who need to talk about mental health are the people who are ill. And of course, we all have mental health, and the things that we do affect the way that we feel and the way that we work, the way that we think, our relationships, all kinds of aspects of the lives we want and the things that we're trying to do depend on our minds. And so actually, I think of mental health as a much broader thing than just trying to fix us when something goes wrong. And what I hope is that by helping everybody to talk more about mental health in general, it makes it easier for people to also talk about problems. Before people can talk about problems with their minds, let's first talk about our minds. And so I say all this in that context, that I'm interested in technology, but also in connection face to face and in helping people who are unwell, but also in helping all of us talk more about our minds. And so with that in mind, I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview of what's going on in the world of tech. When I look back 10 years ago, there was talk a lot about technology for mental health, and certainly everyone wanted an app. Now I think it's probably less faddy and there's a bit more traction, a bit more application, perhaps a few more success stories to point at. It's certainly matured a lot. I think it still has a long way to go though. One thing to bear in mind about mental health is that it's incredibly broad. When I say mental health, you might have certain images that come to mind, images of thinking about particular conditions, perhaps depression or trying to manage stress or various different things that might come to mind, people you know, perhaps your own experiences. But actually, of course, mental health is as broad as physical health, and it encompasses a huge range of different types of experience. And so just in the same way that you can injure yourself, or you can have a cold or a short-term acute illness, or a chronic condition, or a disabling illness, in the same way that you can also have those things with the mind. So the analogy would be that in the same way that you could have a long-term condition like diabetes that needs ongoing management, you might have a mental health condition that's the same, like bipolar disorder, but you might also have a period of bad flu and then recover completely. And similarly, you might have a period of anxiety or depression and then recover completely. And part of the confusion, I think, with trying to talk about this market and what we can do usefully to support each other comes from a mushing together of too many things into one bucket. Because mental health actually can mean all kinds of different things. And so the app world reflects that. And one of the things I hope to achieve with a talk like this is to help at least to segment it a bit, to dive into what previously was a very small vertical and actually start to pull it apart as a set of different segments, which might all have different requirements, different needs, different ways in, different market leaders, different types of clinical outcome, all kinds of different combinations of that. And so as a sort of very brief overview of the kind of thing that we're going to be looking at, the kind of things that you might find if you're looking at mental health apps, it can be a bit overwhelming. There's thousands of the things, and some are very clinically backed, some are not at all. So telling the difference is quite important. Let's go through a few of the different sectors of this, the different areas of it. First, I would say, is probably clinical apps, particularly therapeutic apps. And there are quite a lot of these. They generally draw on cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance commitment therapy is the other popular kind. And the reason that apps work well in that kind of format is that other forms of therapy, humanistic or psychodynamic therapies, very much depend on the relationship with the person. Whereas CBT and other cognitive therapies, there are more exercises, more things for the participant to do, more exercises that they have to go away and do on their own. So there's a lot of attempts to try and use clinical tools to support those. Some just work on access to therapies, others try and augment the therapeutic relationship with other types of engagement and activities. So Big White Wall is one good example of this. Talkspace, WhatsApp, BetterHelp, these are kind of things you might want to look up. You will easily stumble across them in your travels. But I mention those first because I think they're often quite rigorous in their construction. They're often quite clinically backed. They work very hard on safety because they're aimed at people who are in distress, who are struggling. And some people talk about even trying to replace face-to-face therapies. Others talk about it more as being what you do when you haven't got access to a therapist, which of course many people don't, because it's not the easiest thing to get access to psychological therapies or even to mental health treatment. So they play a good role plugging a gap, but they're not necessarily designed to be a replacement for other clinical services, but they're there for people who need them. And then within that, there's quite a lot of condition-specific apps. So you may find that you encounter apps which are, they seem to be very popular, very well thought after, but they're not necessarily targeted at the sort of thing that you're trying to achieve. So for example, there is iMood Journal, which is for bipolar disorder. If you're trying to regulate moods from going to manic or too depressed, try and find those mediums in between. Mood Tools is a good example of one just for depression, so not for mood swings, but for trying to raise your mood. There are Recovery Record is one for eating disorders. NoCD for OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. There are addiction apps like 24 hours a day. And so there's a lot, if you dive into each of these areas, there are lots of specific, very specialist pieces of technology that are designed for people with a very particular need. And I would say that that's probably one of the most fertile areas of growth and of development, because they represent quite specific challenges. They're quite quantifiable, quite easy to measure. And it's a bit like the reason why public health campaigns often end up focusing on smoking cessation. It's partly because we know how to do it. There are a lot of evidence about what we can do to help people quit smoking. But it's also very measurable. You can ask people whether they're smoking. And if they say no, then you mark that as a success. Whereas other things, it's hard to pin down exactly what people might want out of it if you're looking for general benefits from a mental health app. So a lot of them do end up being clinical led and condition specific. Then there are more general things like peer support, which is, I guess, not really designed to connect people to clinical models, but to connect people to other people with the conditions. So this is a classic kind of patients like us model applied into the mental health world. And so Ella Friends, the Minds community, the Sane Support Forum, Ruby Wax's Frazzled Cafe. I think everyone's been feeling a bit like that. And the goal is simply to create some safe spaces, as they call them, to help people talk to each other about these things, but they don't represent clinical interventions. So already we've got quite a lot there. But then we move into tracking and journaling. One of the first apps to do this was Mappiness, which was actually a research project on geography and emotion. But it turned into a very popular app because people liked recording their mood, feeling, noting how happy they were at different times of day. And there are other things like CBT thought record diaries and gratitude journal apps, and Worry Tree is another one. And the goal with a lot of these is to try and help people to reflect, to notice connections between what they do and how they feel, notice when they feel certain ways, where they feel them. And it's, so it, the purpose of it is reflection and awareness. And so they're quite simple. They're not trying to give you advice. They're just trying to help you to note down the information and then see it back in an intelligible way. And then there are more specific things around anxiety. So there's a lot of tools around anxiety and panic, and stress reduction, which blur from being quite clinically led to being more just general kind of tips and meditations, advice on dealing with stress and pressures. And so there are things like Beat Panic, the wonderfully named Chill Panda, and My Possible Self is another one to look out for that. So there's lots of different apps that are all trying to help with this, but they're not necessarily always treating it as a clinical problem. A lot of the time it can be just helping people to calm down. Then that brings me to the biggest growth area in apps, which you might have been expecting me to talk about earlier, which is mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is also one of these very, very popular areas, but it's particularly interesting because it can be applied to many things. So all these different conditions and requirements people might have, a lot of them can be solved through mindfulness meditation. And so apps like Buddhify and Calm and, of course, Headspace, these are all attempts to try and give people tools to meditations, guiding them through. And most of it is about the Vipassana or Buddhist techniques of trying to be non-judgmentally aware of the present moment. And that can be quite good for stress reduction, for depression. It's particularly good for removing rumination, those loops of worry or turning back over past experiences. And so they're not clinical directly, but the practice has clinical benefits, which is a nice route round because they're not necessarily positioning themselves as doctors or a medical intervention, but they do have the potential to be of use to people who are ill as well as people who are well. But it does take work. It takes a lot of effort to learn to meditate. So they're very popular, but they often tend to be popular with people who already have a fair amount of capacity to learn things, to develop skills. And not necessarily great in a crisis. So again, you need to mix it up and use many of them. But they have really pushed through and blazed a trail to get people more and more interested in learning about their minds, which I think has been really positive. Another thing that you will see next to that market is Sleepio and Sleepfulness, and actually Headspace have increasingly marked as a sleep tool as well as a meditation tool. And that tells you a bit about what people are coming to mindfulness for. A lot of it is about calming down and sleeping effectively. And so increasingly Sleep Cycle is another one with a lot of apps which purely focus just on sleep, but again can have a wider benefit to your well-being. And then there's the happiness crowd. Now, Action for Happiness is one example of this, an organization we know well and work with a lot. Some things that you can do to boost your mood, develop more meaningful connections, things that you can try. A lot of them are suggestions of activities that you can do. Happify is another, mood kit, feeling good. They're all quite positive thinking or positive actions. A lot of it based on the work of Martin Seligman and positive psychology. And those can be good. They don't necessarily address everything. Again, if you've got a particular condition, they're not going to help you to beat that, but they can be good for recovery as part of a balanced mental diet. And then you've got a very particular market for teens who get their own apps, things like Me Too, Not Okay, Mind Shift, partly because I think a lot of the time people think teens are aliens and need something completely different, and you have to do everything on TikTok or something, but also it's just that there's quite a lot of groups who are very interested in trying to help young people, and particularly when it's difficult to get access to services. And then, of course, there are general health apps. There are lots of apps and health models that include mental health and well-being as part of it. So there's a huge, huge range of things. And I suppose a few things I wanted to say about it, though. You can look up these apps. You can see what kinds of things you think are of relevance and of interest to you. There's plenty of information online about them all. But I did want to give you five notes of caution about them, that they can't do everything. And the first thing I would say about the limitations of apps for mental health is that they can't replace human contact. We've found out very clearly at the moment that although it's great to see our family and friends on Zoom. It's not the same as going to the pub or having a nice dinner party together or getting round the table for a Sunday lunch. It's important to still remember that we want to connect with other people, and being able to be with each other is a very important part of being mentally well. And being isolated is extremely bad for us. And so whilst these apps can help us to perhaps learn more about ourselves or talk to strangers and connect with therapists, maybe record things that we wouldn't want to talk to someone about, we should never really be focusing, in my view, on apps whose purpose is to replace clinical services, therapists, nurses, peer-to-peer support, friends, family, good management in workplaces. They're not a replacement for human contact. They're also not replacements for clinical services. A lot of the purpose of them is often to augment clinical services. And although, of course, if you haven't got access to clinical services, you'll take whatever you can get. The aspiration is not that services should be cut and replaced by these apps. The aspiration would be that a therapist might use an app to help you to reflect on your condition more and feel more connected to the therapist. But it's not designed to replace the day-to-day human connections that we need. The third thing is that sometimes what can happen is people become over-vigilant and start using apps to try and change themselves. And it's not really always necessary to change yourself. Sometimes the right thing to do is to just let things be, to work through emotions in a natural way, that it's not the end of the world if you feel anxious, if you feel sad. A lot of the time, the right thing is just to allow your mind to feel the way it wants. And the worry that can sometimes creep in, particularly with the kind of quantified self movement, is that people start to become anxious about trying to track how they feel. The other thing I would say is don't confuse well-being with health. And so a lot of them do aspire to generally raising well-being levels, but that's not the same as preventing mental ill health. And you do need to look at what exactly is the goal you're trying to create and what the app is trying to do. Because actually you can end up doing things that are generally designed to help you to feel better, but what you're looking for is something more specific, or vice versa. The final thing about it is that there aren't any one-size-fits-all solutions. Mindfulness works for some people, but not for others. Some people really love gratitude journaling, other people don't. And it's so pick from what you have, pick from what you can get access to, but don't feel that if something doesn't work, then that means that it's on you because it should work. It may not. And actually, all the evidence we have about mental health, it suggests that what's good for our minds is often what we choose and what we enjoy, and feeling that autonomy and picking things that fit well with us. Even in therapy, it's about finding a therapist that fits you. And the same is true with an app. Find an app that you have a good relationship with. So I would expect this is an area where there will be many winners, many popular tools, because there isn't going to be one single way of treating people or helping people to feel well. And so with all that in mind, I should say what we're trying to do with Mind Apples, we have an app that's poised to come out shortly. It was slightly delayed by the pandemic, but we'll be hopefully coming out with a free version very soon. What we're trying to do is plug a gap, which is around education, learning about our minds. So our app will be focused on helping people to learn about aspects of mental functioning, well-being, what they can do to look after themselves, but to reflect on that and to connect in with a bit of peer support to try and see what other people are doing. So for example, to listen to some audio or watch a video about the importance of sleep, but then to share what helps you to sleep, and then to see what other people have said helps them. And so we're taking more of a peer learning and reflective practice approach to things. And our goal is not to compete with anyone else. It's simply to find that niche for people who have tried other things. Maybe they have successfully used a meditation app, but they're looking for a bit more, and we're hoping to plug the gap with that. And that feels like our place in all of that. But there's plenty more places, I think, that people will find themselves. And the final thing I would say, just to wrap all of this up, is that if you can see the general breadth of this, the number of apps around, the uses of technology, it's only going to grow. And generally what we're seeing at the moment is an explosion of awareness that looking after our minds matters. And we're talking about all kinds of general global effects on our mental health at the moment through the COVID pandemic. And it's not the case that everybody has suddenly developed an illness. We're obviously experiencing a collective trauma, collective pressures on us to change our habits, to deal with loss, to deal with changes, to adapt and be resilient in the face of all this. And it's pointing more and more to the need for all of us to understand our minds, know what we want, and take steps to be able to get what we need from our life, our work, our health, and our relationships. And so I expect that this is an area that will only continue to grow. But I hope that it is also matched by an uptick in clinical provision, in general awareness and conversations, and in face-to-face conversations and support, as well as apps. We can't just rely on the tech. to solve our problems for us, but it can certainly help, and it's doing wonders for helping people to see their way through to managing themselves and doing something positive to take that next step in the right direction. And so with that, I will finish up. Thank you very much for your time. It's been really nice to spend a little bit of time with you. If you want to know more about Mind Apples, then check out mindapples.org. You can also sign up to initial trials for the free version of the app. And I will finish with our slogan at Mind Apples, which is to make looking after our minds as natural as brushing our teeth. If you think about dental health compared to mental health, it's only one letter different, and yet so different in the way that we talk about it. And so if you think about how much worse it is for your mind to fall apart than for your teeth to fall out, how much more destructive it is for your relationships, how much harder it is to fix, how much damage it does to your work, to your life, compared to something going wrong with your dental health, then why is it that we have a $1 billion global market of products and services to keep our teeth healthy, and we hardly talk about our minds? And I think this is huge growth area in personal health and well-being and in social progress, that we can start looking after our minds the same way as we look after every other aspect of our health.
Andy, a huge thanks for joining us on this podcast episode of She Talks Tech. We hope you enjoyed that session. If you want to find out more about Andy and his work at Mind Apples, you can find him on LinkedIn or look him up on Twitter. And a huge thank you to all of you for listening. We really, really appreciate it. Don't forget, we release a new episode of She Talks Tech every Wednesday. If you like what you hear, don't forget to give us that all-important 5-star rating.